This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hi, it's Stephen Colbert, and I'm here to tell you about The Late Show Pod Show, which is the podcast of The Late Show with me, Stephen Colbert, and I'm here with my producer of the podcast, Becca. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Stephen.
So what do people get when they listen to The Late Show Pod Show? Let's sell this thing.
The extended moments, for sure, because we run out of time for broadcast, but we have plenty of time on the podcast.
It's kind of like being a live audience member of the show because you get things that no one else hears. Listen to The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to episode 164 of What Most People Think. Jeff is back in the country. At the weekend, I went to a family wedding in the south of... Was it in the south of... I don't even know where it was in France. I flew to an airport. Someone drove me to a place. It was definitely French. I could tell that by the hand gestures and the amount of bread and cheese. And that sounds incredibly stereotypical, but it is actually true. And I was the celebrant at my sister's wedding. I've got to say, man, I think that there is an industry in there. I wasn't like, you know, I didn't have to do any qualifications or anything, but the ego that goes with marrying two people, I was talking like, you know the vicar in The Simpsons? We are gathered here today to join in matrimony, holy and forthright, and hellfire and damnation. I didn't say hellfire and damnation, but there is that incredible thing about weddings, isn't there? Like, obviously, women have a lot of stress. A hell of a lot of stress about what they're going to wear, how they're going to prepare, you know, free choices of outfits, all this stuff. But in fairness, the payoff to that is that they might wear an outfit that people will remember for all time. Oh my God, you that dress you wore with the bodice and the lace back. You know, women will remember that shit. As a man, I don't know anybody that go, oh, Jeff, do you remember that suit that you wore for that wedding that was the suit that you were wearing during that 3-year period generally for all formal events? Oh, you look so... I mean, the best you can get as a man is that someone will say, oh, you look smart. That's it. You look smart. You scrub up well. Whereas women will get like that. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. You're a vision. I just got goosebumps looking at you. No one ever got goosebumps looking at the groom. Unless the groom was one of that top 1% of good-looking men, they can get that reaction. But you've just got to be Bradley Cooper or David Beckham. I don't know. A lot of people have gone off Beckham. But he did queue, didn't he? He queued for the Queen. Not like Holly and Phil. Not like Holly. It's amazing how much shit they're getting for that. I mean, it was one of those issues that I struggled to be motivated over. But like, just the way, just what a big issue this has become now is that we all have very strong views on. I mean, like, they couldn't have done anything more offensive to the British public. Even the guy that tried to sort of like break out of line and approach the coffin, it was like, at least he queued. And before anyone, for the right wingers now try, because I've had a couple of people messaging me going, that was a bit flippant, that was a bit inappropriate. Fuck you. I'm a comedian first, but I do love the royal family. Just going back, yeah, we'll talk about that a bit as the show goes on. But just going back to the wedding, one of the things I realised on the following day, everyone had a good drink on the Saturday night and on the Sunday. There's various terminology that goes with being hungover, isn't there? One is like, I don't feel too bad, actually. Those people just want to slap, don't they? I don't feel too bad, actually. Look, one is you're still drunk, all right? Well, what that really means is, given the fucking toxic amount of alcohol that I threw down my neck, I don't want to kill myself. So that's not too bad. And then there's I feel a bit delicate. They do want to kill themselves. And then there's just another one where they don't make a noise. When you ask them how they are and they just raise their eyebrows, they can't, just speaking just feels like another tiny death. So there was a bit of that going on. There's a bit of that going on. And then we flew back on the Sunday night. And of course, there was the royal funeral on the Monday. And then when it came to, oh, by the way, you know, this, if you've listened to this for the first time, this is what most people think. This is, I suppose, a podcast from the comedy world that I'm sure there were plenty of my colleagues in comedy that had some affection for the Queen. Certainly looking at social media, they weren't a majority. So I'm happy to admit that I watched the funeral, I got emotional, and it turns out that I have, well, riderless ponies. Those who know, right? That moment where you saw the rider, that it's a pony, she loved ponies. No, her on the pony. I'll go if I start. And bagpipes. What was about the lone bagpipe? But that guy got me twice. So first up in the service at Westminster Abbey, I'm like, where's he going? Don't go. Don't go, bagpiper. Stay. And I was like, okay, fuck, I didn't realise that would make me so emotional. Then we had the riderless pony. And then bagpipe guy strikes again, doesn't he? I'm like, don't you dare walk away. Don't you dare walk away. But look, I would say this is that, you know, I have some sympathy for how, you know, the coverage in the intervening period between the Queen dying and the funeral did get to some weird places. But I would say that the day itself, man, I don't know who planned that day, but could they please do Brexit and other things? You know, could they take over the economy? Because that was a fucking roaring success. Okay, the main talking point. Last episode, we were talking about many things, really, but also the surname Goebbels, because there's certain surnames, really, that's, you know, historically, is a big shout to still have them. And we were wondering if there were still any people left called Goebbels. David informed us that Goebbels still exists in Teutonic world, mostly Western Germany. There was recently a socialist MEP from Luxembourg with that surname. Himmler and Goering can still be found too, but Hitler is rare now. Presumably owing to people changing their surname. I mean, yeah. I mean, anyone, if you've still got that name. And look, you go, look, my family haven't done anything wrong. It was our family name long before that guy started ruining it for the Hitlers. I mean, didn't he absolutely ruin it for us Hitlers? Eh? There's just probably about four of them that have left there. A WhatsApp group, you know, because they couldn't go on Facebook because they'd attract the wrong kind. We also spoke last week with Andrew Doyle about the sugar glass maker, and we spoke about poetry, and then we sort of came to a conclusion that there was something about the fact that you could make very beautiful things with sugar glass, like fake glass for film sets and stuff, but they would always be broken. And a couple of people took up the offer to write a really shit poem about the sugar glass maker, so I'll read a couple of them out. This is from David Smith. The sugar glass maker, her bottles are faker. Then a couple of old lesbians, by the way, that's a reference from last week's show before the cancel brigade, pipe up. Her bottles are faker than a couple of old lesbians. Frightening, scared thespians. Thespian, I like that because that rhyme doesn't properly work. Class struggle will prevail. Davy Boy Smith's holy grail. So set it up, comrade, because this poem is A grade. I like that. I mean, the rhyme scheme is fucking all over the shop. We've got some half rhymes there that don't really work. Good effort. We've also got this from Tim Crudders. So this is, again, his take on the sugar glass maker. Weep for the demotivated sugar glass makers. No wonder there's not that many takers. In brackets. Love the use of brackets there. So bad. A shattering task to manufacture. A product destined for immediate fracture. They've got the bottle, but they've got the arse. Not even allowed to make proper glass. More brackets. It hurts like a blow across the head. ... But not really. I mean, Tim, I love your use of punctuation there to make it worse. The brackets made it worse. And then the ... or the ellipsis, he says, as a former English teacher. But not really. Just so incongruous and clunky. Well played, everybody there. New patrons. So at board level, by the way, board level members, check your messages because a very significant board level benefit has been communicated to you. And that is in the works. Also, by the way, this is for all patrons. I'm looking at doing a Jeff Norcott and Friends gigs next year. A couple of gigs in the spring. And this will be in London and Leeds. And I'm sorry, I know there's lots of places, but I just have to pick places where I know promoters, friendly promoters that can put on the show and aren't, you know, overly sensitive about who we book and stuff like that. So that will be in the spring of next year, two shows, one in London, one up north. And that'll be a bit like a What Most People Think get together. That'll be guaranteed free entry for board members and VIPs. Probably I'll also be able to offer tickets at all tiers, but I'll just have to see what the initial take up is like. So just keep your eyes out for that. That's a significant Patreon benefit at all levels, which will be coming very soon. At board level, a board member, and these are people that are voluntarily upgraded to 20 quid and above. We had Andrew Welch. Now, I spoke about Andrew the other week, and I did some shit joke about him Welching on the deal. And God love him, he went to 20 quid and then took it back down again. He Welched on the deal. What? I mean, this is commitment to the bit. And then he went back up. He went back up. So he's still a board member. And Karen, get him a coffee. We got some VIPs. John Winter, I think there seem to be a lot of returners there, as I keep saying. Patreon always bump you out. Thank you to the people that check and then get involved again. But John Winter, I mean, I probably did this one first time, John. But whenever you get invited somewhere in a WhatsApp group, it must give you great pleasure to say, winter is coming. Winter is coming. I mean, Game of Thrones reference there. And this one, I think, is definitely a new one. It's Ian Spammon. Ian Spammon, is that a real name? I'm Googling this. Surname? No. It's not your real name, Ian Spammon. Ian Spammon. I mean, what you do sound like. You sound like a fucking Viz character, don't you? Ian Spammon, just about some kid with a gigantic spam. He's probably been withdrawn as a character because of political correctness. You know, yeah, we shouldn't actually, you know, there are a lot of sort of hereditary reasons people might have massive foreheads. But back in the day, Ian Spammon was well funny, like. Okay, let's do a quick thank you and a fuck you. Fuck, I haven't told you who this week's guest is. What? We've got a brilliant guest, Josh Howie. Josh is a comic I've worked with for many years. Josh, some of you will know him for appearing on GB News Headliners. He's written sitcoms. He's also been on a bit of a political journey himself, you know, being of the Jewish faith having debates and discussions with people during the Corbyn years on the left. He's also got involved in a number of other sort of hot button debates, which make him a very interesting person to talk to. So I'll be speaking to him shortly. But before that, let's have the thank you and the fuck you. So I promised not to mention social media too much in this episode, but there was a very funny moment with Zara Sultana. Zara Sultana, who does still sound like, to me, a sort of character in a J.K. Rowling book, which I think would probably be a massive insult to her. But she's very progressive and right on, very left wing, part of the Enough is Enough campaign. Got a lot of fans and stuff, but she overreached slightly here. She said, my train to Leeds for tonight's Enough is Enough rally has just stopped just outside London for the last 3 hours. Sorry not to be there, Leeds. And then she uses this to make a political point. Just another reminder that we need to bring rail into public ownership and make it fit for the future. God bless London North Eastern Railway, LNER. Some guy called Cameron who deserves a fucking medal. He says, I'm sorry for the delay, Zara. This was due to damage on the overhead electric wires, meaning services could not move around Stevenage, but services are now on the move. On your other point, LNER is owned by the DfT after the franchise was handed back in 2018. Boo! I think Cameron, I don't know if Cameron's a Tory or he just gets sick of people saying that. But yeah, that was a bit of fun there. You know, I'm sure Zara Sultana will take it in good humour. Because, I mean, if anything, her tweet then actually points to the fact maybe we shouldn't renationalise railways. If essentially, her tweet achieved the opposite of what she wanted. We've all been there, mate. Don't worry about it, Zara. And the fuck you is to Vladimir Putin. I mean, when you stop and think about how this prick has sort of changed the fabric of our sort of political timeline because of whatever insecurities and just antiquated views about Russia. And I mean, it's a lot, isn't it? You know, it's gone badly for him recently in Ukraine. It's quite clear now. At first I thought, you know, is this just Western spin? But, you know, it's quite clear that with a lot of backing, the Ukrainian forces have launched a decent counterattack. So he's now given this speech where he's gone for the partial mobilisation of all Russia. I mean, if there is a sign to any kind of sort of Russian who's a bit in the middle, like, I don't think it's going that well. Just saying, my uncle got called up. So maybe a special military operation in Ukraine. Not so snappy. He's then insinuated again, as he has many times, about nuclear weapons. He always points to London as well. It's almost like, you know, America's the big lad and Britain is the slightly smaller lad. So he's thinking, oh, I'm not going to piss off the big lad too much. You go, but London, I'll fuck you up one time. a nuclear bomb for London. Well, you might want to check that with your mates who own property here, mate. I mean, that might be the final thing that actually gets Putin out of power. Like, he just gets some sort of coup of Russian oligarchs going, he's lost it this time. I have £21 million mansion in London. Fuck you. But I also thought, like, at this point, as we're moving into autumn, right, you know, sad news around, what with the Queen, rising prices, life's tough. You know, it's weird still, post-COVID, that weirdness that none of us really talk about, the weirdness, you know, the post-COVID weirdness that hasn't really left. I'm like, you know what, bring it on. Stop going on about it, Vladimir. Send that fucking nuke over here. It'll be a blessed relief for some of us. I feel very tired at the moment. I don't know about you, since the temperature's dropped, I'm struggling to get up in the mornings. And yeah, you know, a nuclear war, I'd warm up nicely and then I'd be dead and all of this would be over. So yeah, don't fucking say it. We got to walk the walk, Vladimir. And he actually said, he also said, I'm not bluffing, really. I mean, man, people that aren't bluffing tend to not need to say that they're bluffing. 100%. I swear down. I swear. Do you remember when you was a kid? People would swear, they'd always try and pull in someone emotive. I swear on my little brother's life. I swear on my little brother's life. And I fucking love him like so much as well. So don't you dare say that I don't. Because that boy is everything to me. I swear, I'm not bluffing. I mean, as phrases go, I'm not bluffing is up there with, I like a good joke as much as the next man. No, you don't. The next thing that you're going to say is something that shows that you're a humorless prick. And so is Vladimir Putin. Yeah, if you're listening, Russia, fucking set your sights on where I live, okay? Take me out. If you want to give a sign to the West, I'm ready. I could do with the PR. Okay, it's time for the chat with Josh Howie. I should say I've recorded this again after the chat because what happened, there was loads of stuff I wanted to speak to about Josh. But once we got speaking about and the Corbyn years and what it was like for Josh, who is a Jewish man and a left-wing person, to be in and around that side of the fence politically, I just felt it was really compelling. So just to let you know, that is going to be, you know, sort of Josh talking about that time in history a lot. And I hope you find it as compelling as I did. So let's get into it with the chat with Josh Howie. A warm welcome, making his debut on What Most People Think, is the brilliant Josh Howie. Josh, welcome to the show.
Hello, lovely to see you.
So we are recording this on Wednesday night, and you were racing against the clock. So you were coming back from somewhere on a plane. Where had you been?
I had been in Sark, in the Channel Islands. So I had like got a ferry, a bus, a plane, a train, a bus, and then the car to pick up the kids.
And you know the worst thing is with podcasts is that, you know, there's certain working engagements where your other half will understand why you're stressing, yeah. But saying I need to be back for this podcast doesn't really carry much weight.
Not when you've got five kids and you've been away for 2 days. So
you've
I got
five kids.
Yeah, this is why I'm in my I should explain to listeners, we're on Zoom, so we can see each other, so you can see in the background I'm in my daughter's bedroom.
There's a very creepy, old-fashioned looking baby doll just staring.
Oh, should I move it?
Staring against the wall.
Is it this one?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like the one. Yeah, just got thrown against the wall. It's a good thing we're not putting this out. So if people wanted to grab that bit, they'd wonder what kind of club we were in.
It's not
So that was that getting away with the kids, and or is it?
No. And weirdly enough, Andrew Doyle. I hope he doesn't mind me saying this, but I got invited. He had a bunch of mates, and it was like a last minute thing. And friend Martin, you know, headliners, it's on GB News, and they went away, and they were like, "Hey, do you want to come?" And it was great. It was just a really lovely couple of days. A friend of mine, Miriam, who's a brilliant artist, she used to be a stand up, and it was very chill. Didn't talk politics,
were
you, any of that. It was just all very
you
nice.
Fascists together. I yeah, bet you any
exactly.
money.
Yeah, well, that's, I'm sure, how some people would like to, but actually, it was us playing card game that I bought called Skulking and trying to. I'm basically, my brainwashing isn't political, my brainwashing is to get people into board games.
Into board games, that is in some ways more sinister,
absolutely, because it's a much bigger money pit than anything.
Than fascism.
Yeah, it just takes up a lot more time and energy, and it just takes over in a way that I imagine fascism doesn't.
So speaking of fascism, obviously there are some people that saw the royal family, the royal funeral as evidence of its further creep into British public life. Were you away for the funeral, or were you across?
I was travelling as the funeral was going on, I feel somewhat part of the whole thing just because we went on air a couple of days after, and I did a couple of shows on TV in the aftermath of the Queen's death. And it was very strange. I nearly started giggling on the first one just because it's surreal. We were all in, you know, wearing black suits, yeah, and you've got to be somber. And whilst I had real emotion, you know, upon finding out her death, but suddenly you're in a studio a few days later and it's very, very surreal.
I mean, that pressure is everyone's the 14-year-old kid.
Yes.
Back at a church or any religious sort of like a place of worship, and you're told you do not laugh.
You have to be. So, and me more so, because I am, as you know, just a bit of an idiot. So it's very weird to suddenly find yourself in this adult type environment meant to be pontificating about this stuff. But what is kind of great, and I guess this ties into stuff we'll talk about, is doing this headliner show, which, for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's where you're going over the next day's news headlines and through the next day's newspapers, is it really, because you're explaining these stories and then trying to come up with like hot takes on it, it forces you to actually have an opinion about stuff that you wouldn't and it's not that people don't necessarily have opinions, they might have gut reactions, but when you're forced to articulate things, you really have to sort of do a much more of a deep dive into all of these events that happen. And obviously nothing has been a bigger event than the Queen's death. I'm just saying, that of course includes the republicanism and what we think about King Charles now and all of that stuff.
I mean obviously it's GB News, it has a show called Free Speech Nation. I guess it must have been tricky for them to then go, by the way lads, just
tone it down. Well, this is the great thing, is that no one has ever said, say this, say that. Oh, the only rule is not swearing. And I don't know. I assume you prefer me probably not to swear. I don't know.
I don't know. I love swearing.
So okay, yeah, because I'm just a massive swearer. So that's the hard part for me. But in terms of I've never had any input of, please tone that bit down or whatever. You're given total free rein.
Yeah. And
that is just such an insane pleasure to be able to have a voice and to not feel constrained in any way. But certainly there was this idea, just you're picking up on the tone of everything. So there is some self-censorship to a degree in terms of the Queen, but not that I had like any desire to.
Well, I mean, that was what I thought was interesting. And I suppose, you know, I saw some funny stuff about the news, because obviously when people say, oh, you're making jokes about the Queen, a lot of the funnier jokes weren't really, they were about things that you would notice about the coverage or the tropes or the phrases that became really common. And it was interesting that you know, there were people arrested for having signs saying not my king, you know, these kind of things. So so that kind of mobilised the left-wing free speech movement, which was refreshing. It's been a while, isn't it?
Nice to see them step up when it affects them.
Well, we'll see when the next time sort of comes around to see if they've really rediscovered that voice. But I suppose in a way, you know, what's often called cancel culture, it's a little bit of a misnomer, because the problem is you can then go, well, that person was cancelled, but they're still working. So it's a bad word in a way. What it really means is hypersensitivity and excessive consequences for small things. To me, is that how you sort of see it? It's not about people never being able to work again. It's just about the ridiculous reactions to one tweet or one joke.
Well, I mean, there are some people who aren't able to work again, and then there are some people, the ones you hear, this is the difference, it's the ones you hear about, then they go, well, so people go, oh, well, cancel culture isn't real, but because of the result of you hearing about what happened, like that artist who was doing the, doing sort of embroidery, and she had her work banned from the Royal Academy of Art, I think, because it was sort of saying women exist or something, you know, it was something like science. And so they pulled all of her artwork. And because of that, she had a voice that she never had before, because lots of people were pulling their membership from the Royal Academy of Art. And then also she was selling more. So people would look at that and go, well, she didn't really get cancelled because, well, only because they kicked up a stink about it. And same with Kathleen Stock. We wouldn't have heard necessarily of Kathleen Stock, who she explained to some listeners that she's a philosopher who wrote a book, Material Girls, all about like the eradication of the term women, and all this is all goes into sort of gender ideology. And her kind of, I think she was at Sussex University, and the abuse that she had over years, not being defended by the university at all. And people go, but then because now she's got this book or because she's got a higher profile, they would go, oh, well, she hasn't been cancelled. That doesn't mean that people didn't try to cancel her. So it's maybe
and the experience.
Yeah.
And I often think that, you know, I spoke recently about Jimmy Carr, and one thing I regret leaving out was just that, of course, he's a wealthy man, and, you know, I hesitate to use words privilege, because I think that he has good things in his life because he works hard to get them.
Yeah.
But the stress of that process still exists whether you're wealthy or not, you know, just thinking that people are talking about you, thinking that people hate you, you know, feeling like you've upset people, all of that stuff. And then they may well just say, well, that's the consequence. But in some ways, in a way, in comedy, we've got it better than some other industries. Because when you talk about, like you say, ballet, theatre, the art world, it's not as high profile in a lot of respects. And there's a lot of stuff that's happened there that we just haven't heard as much about.
That is the big point, isn't it? Is that people try and say that cancel culture isn't real because they pick on these few cases where there are attempted cancels and it maybe backfired or raised people's profiles bigger. But of course, you're not seeing that all these other cancellations that have had an effect in there and people's, you know, and certainly like you say, in the arts, these things are higher profile. But what about the people who have lost their jobs in normal jobs, nurses, whoever it is who've presented facts that go counter to the narrative and thus haven't got the promotion they wanted? Or you're seeing a lot of stuff in tech where certain people who have lost their job and then you only read about the case like 2 years later or something, and they have lost everything. There are people out there who have lost everything for stating that that sex is binary, you know, it's happened. And then sometimes you hear about it only long after the fact. So someone like J.K. Rowling, of course she hasn't been cancelled, but if they could, these activists would erase her figuratively some of them in reality.
Just to sort of give people an idea of sort of where you're coming from politically. Yeah. So, like, if you just talk about like sort of left-right politics, say one is the far left, 10 is the far right, and five, you know, 5 and 6 are in the middle. Where would your politics typically
Probably four.
So four. Sort of center left.
Center left, yeah. I mean, there's a great cartoon somewhere where of this there's like little of someone picking up the sign that says left and walking to it and putting themselves down, and now it's like the far left is gone so far left, you know, so the people on the far left wouldn't consider me a four, you know what I mean? For them, the scale, if you're not a one or a two, then you're a 10. Everybody else is a 10 for them.
Yeah.
And that's what's kind of, for me, arguably got this country partly the reason we are. And I'm sure that extremism goes on both sides, but for me, the far left have a lot to answer for in terms of the present predicament in getting Boris Johnson into power and whatever, because of the purity politics and the purity spiral and no one ever being good enough.
When did that start to register for you? Because obviously we know under Corbyn, the problem of anti-Semitism on the left was eventually fairly well documented. Yeah. But when did you first get the stirrings that you were on a side where, hang on, you're looking around, you go, I'm not sure I'm in the trenches with the right people.
Yeah. It's, well, this is it. I think most people, I mean, look, people are listening to a podcast that they're more likely to be politically engaged. But the reality is, I think, that most people aren't and are quite comfortable in whatever tribe they happen to find themselves in, even from family or background. My parents worked for the Labour Party, even though my parents were wealthy, but they did the PR. I grew up sort of that Thatcher was bad and Labour was good, and I just voted Labour as a default. And that's probably, and then I remember Corbyn kind of getting in, or even during the election campaign for him to be Labour leader. And there were people I knew who, and Jewish people, like, yeah, okay, like, didn't really know anything about him, but I think people were just kind of feeling frustrated with what had happened over the previous few years, and Ed Miliband hadn't worked out great. So people were, and I think there was a general sense, and I sort of went along with it to a degree, of excitement of someone who was different, who wasn't part of the political machine, seemingly. He seemed to have this integrity or whatever.
Yeah.
And almost immediately, some little reports would start coming up. And there's this idea now, because we're going to have to talk about like Israel and stuff, is that...
I mean, we should state that you are Jewish as well.
Yeah, so I'm Jewish. The default argument is from people defending the anti-Semitism was, oh, he just criticized Israel. But his allies were extremists. And, you know, my great friend, you know, he was friends with people who murdered Jews. It's not just like him calling for peace in the Middle East.
Yeah.
He's hanging out with extremists. And so more and more started coming out. And I guess this is what did it for me, was being gay. You know, I used to use Twitter as a way of just trying out gags, really.
Like, yeah, do you remember those old days?
Remember those? Yeah, no, really, those were good times. It was like...
Yeah, yeah, but now I get this thing wherever I do a slightly duff tweet, I get thousands of people going, see, this is right-wing comedy. I'm like, yeah, it's all in this fucking tweet.
Yeah,
this thing that I come up with while I was having a shit, it's all here.
Exactly. And that's what it was for. And it was like, oh, and then you'd be surprised, because you know what it's like, you're a comic. As long as you've been doing it, sometimes you still get surprised by the joke you think's a bit mediocre suddenly is your biggest closer, and a joke you think is genius, and you get better at being able to read what's going to work and what isn't, but still it's worth chucking stuff out there and seeing what hits the wall, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
What sticks or not. And so that's the way that I use Twitter. And then just you start seeing things that you know to not be true, whether it's comics putting stuff up or people who are associated with them and sort of saying, oh, this is a lie. And when you know something to be true, or saying things like, oh, it's just because he's anti-Israel. And you're like, well, no, he did go and lay a wreath at someone who chopped off the balls of a Jewish athlete. You know what I mean? He laid a wreath to commiserate the death of a terrorist. That's a fact. And when you got people who are just like, and that's his words, he wrote it in the Morning Star and all this stuff. So when you get people like then, or him liking a mural, an anti-Semitic mural, or...
Yes, I remember that. I mean, it was almost, not that it would ever be comic, but it's almost comically anti-Semitic, you know, where you think of like some lad who's 17 years old, he's doing sociology and he just wants to get some girls. And he's like, oh, it's my new satire on Zionism.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's got all the tropes. It's got big noses. It's got just them grabbing money. Obviously, the racism is one thing, but it's really shit. Is the other thing. Yeah. That's also offensive.
And the thing is, it all adds up. But this at that point, even if Corbyn had said, and even if his followers had said, yeah, that's a bit messed up. Yeah, I could see how that's an anti-Semitic trope. I can see why that's upsetting. Things wouldn't have gone down the route that it did, but they didn't. And this is why this is the problem, is at that point they doubled down in the, it's not that he did anything wrong. It's that Josh, or the few people who were trying to fight this stuff you're just pointing this out because you don't want, because he's anti-Zionist and you're a Zionist, and or because you're actually a Tory and you want the Tories to get in, or because you're rich and you don't want to pay taxes, and all of these things. And that's what suddenly made it way, way worse, because something like certainly the rich thing, and Sophie Hagen put out a tweet, I remember, just in the run up, she's a comic, but and she put out a thing just saying, oh, all this complaint about Corbyn is just because people, they don't want to pay their taxes or whatever. And it was such a sort of, you're like, whoa, like, what? Is that what you're saying? This whole thing is actually started because what, Jews have money, Jews are stingy. Like, there's so much to unpack there. And then she put out later, like, only after it gotten like 20,000 tweets, it's still up there. Oh, I'm sorry that people think that, that, but that's not what I mean. I need to educate myself. Yeah, but you're not deleting it.
And one thing I've got to go, you know, is how hard is it like to be a Jewish person that's not doing well financially? Because this stereotype must be, it must fucking suck.
I'm in an ex-council flat. I've got my five kids in a three-bedroom ex-council flat with no garden. Look, I come from a wealthy background. I can't deny that. But my parents don't give me money. I'm making it as a stand-up. Things are better now than they were, but things were definitely like very tough. Certainly like a couple of years ago, and then going into COVID, really, really tough. So that stuff really is super duper frustrating. But what, and the other thing is, you know, I go to, my kids go to a Jewish school, and you're at the gates and with the other sort of parents Jewish. Now it's like, okay, one of my kids just had a play date with someone. They've got a proper big old house. It's like my kids are like, dad, you're a loser, as I pick them up. And then, but that's like one person. And then there's some people who work, one of the moms works at the airport and doing security, and one, and then there's essentially a lot of teachers, there's a lot of estate agents, there's a lot of middle class people, with a few extremes of few people who actually have a bit of money, not necessarily millionaires, but definitely you know, doing well. And then and a few people, including myself, that are just got clinging on. That's the reality of it. The idea that we're all Jews are wealthy and whatever, it drives me totally batty. But I just wanted to say that all of this is because the far left, and this bleeds into the left, all of it happened because they wanted to feel like they were good people, that they couldn't possibly be anti-racist or be supporting someone who is racist. So rather than just admit it, like, we all make mistakes, or we all, you know, we all don't know the full information or whatever it is. But if Corbyn had just put his hands up and go, yeah, I see that's an anti-Semitic trope. But what did he do every time? No, I am not racist. I am a good human being. What do his supporters think? We are not racist. It's impossible for us to be racist because we are on the left. So, i.e., you have to have some insidious motive for saying that he, and thus we, are being racist, rather than just kind of going, well, maybe we need to look at that. What most
people think. Then there was also the thing with Corbyn, whereby he would say, I deplore that and all kinds of racism. Yeah. It was all qualified. So it was kind of like, must have been a bit of a mad time for someone, you know, who's yourself, you know, was nominally a Labour voter of the left, a comic as well, culture. It must have been quite a confusing time when you just looked around and things that are being said in and around.
It wasn't confusing. It was maddening and upsetting. And I'm still somewhat, you know, 2019 was at the peak of it at that election. And I'm still somewhat traumatized from the whole experience. I've still lost, there are still friends I've lost, best friends from that whole experience. And I'm still angry about it, to be honest, because I actually don't really like using the term gaslighting. So, it was unending. And this is what people don't seem to get, is first of all, how few Jews there are in this country, about sort of 250,000, whatever. And of that 250,000, most, like most of the population, just want to get on with their lives. So it's not like, say, let's go back to the analogy of the school gates. Of the couple of hundred parents at my school, I pretty much am the only one who was actually really actively engaged in fighting this stuff. Now, the rest of everybody else did think, like 86% of the Jewish population in this country, that Corbyn is an anti-Semite. But most of them just get on with their lives because they're just trying to get by. But for me, it was a slightly worse or more intense because, like you say, being a comic and you're in a sort of traditionally left industry, was half of my friends are friends from that side or from the arts, and half of my friends are people, other parents at this Jewish school, and they were slightly more in their little bubble where they weren't seeing the constant onslaught of social media stuff that I get from Facebook, from Twitter. There are comics that I've known, you know, 20 years, and putting up the most outrageous things, like actual anti-Semitic things, and no one cares. And and comics who are meant to be all anti-racist and all this stuff, and no one backing me up. A few other Jewish comics, and that's been the hardest part of it all, is feeling somewhat alone. And the only people who really been fighting this, and this idea, and again, this goes down to like these anti-Semitic jokes, like, oh, Israel is interfering in the elections, this is what they'd say, and all this stuff. It's like, mate, I'm here, I'm behind the curtain, and the curtain is me and about 50 other Jews fighting probably about 100,000 Corbynites. So in just in a pure numbers game, when you have got these pylons and the being swamped, and now it's probably about 200 Jews and maybe 100 allies and other people who'll do the occasional retweet or whatever. But the reality is, at the peak, it was probably like 100 to 200,000 of these like far left people just piling on. And there was just a couple of hundred of us trying to almost hold back that tide. And that was the hardest part of it. And people linking to blogs that is like started up by a Holocaust denier, and just like mad, just it just got so mental.
One of the first times, obviously I was aware of some of these blind spots, and I remember when I did in about 2018, I made a joke about Corbyn and anti-Semitism on Mash Report.
I said
something like, he's like a gangster's wife. He might not have killed anybody personally, but he knows where the shovel's.
Yeah,
at.
Yeah.
I remember like so many people from Jewish community reached out, and when I spoke to them, and I realized speaking to people just how undefended they felt at that time, because like you say, it felt insane that the things that a modern Western liberal culture is supposed to care about, that there was somehow like a bit of a pass for it, and that to attack Corbyn for that was to attack left-wing policies somehow.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I say, tying into that, we must have some ulterior motive rather than just, if anybody had just said, including Corbyn, you know, yeah, I can see that maybe I need to do some work on some stuff or whatever. But just this doubling, it's never ending doubling down. And the reason why it gets worse and worse is because then it's like that, you know, the AHRC, Equality Human Rights Commission, then they're investigating Labour, the only other political party being investigated ever for racism, being the BNP. And then you'd sort of say that to them. And then it came out and they found that Labour had broken the law. But the only way and even at that point, people are so invested in still thinking they're not racist, that they're a good human being, that suddenly they're like, well, the only way that can be explained is that the AHRC is being controlled by Jews and being controlled. And then they're going down into these sort of exactly the racist conspiracy theories that they're saying aren't real, or that they're saying that. And then it becomes this sort of cycle.
It's obviously like, you know, I can see the effect this had on you. Is there a part of you, you know, like you do GB News, and then that is contentious among certain comics. Are you doing the Comedy Unleashed tour, which we should hype, actually? Yeah. Doing some dates on that. I'm going to be at Portsmouth this Friday. But is there a part of you that after this process just thought, fuck it? Do you know what I mean? Like,
not fuck it, fuck you.
Yeah.
So
these comics, things...
Like, how fucking dare they try and police what I say, who I speak to, whatever. Because as far as I'm concerned, they have behaved abysmally during that whole time. And worse than that, they're just fucking hypocrites. That's the thing. It's the hypocrisy. And we're all hypocrites to agree, and none of us are perfect. But they genuinely think that they are, that their shit doesn't stink, that they've never said anything wrong ever. And that's the stuff that winds me up. Like, I'm going on, I'm going on GB News. Oh, what? I'm going on and I'm arguing for a Labour government now. I'm arguing for policies, what I believe are fairer policies for our society. And that somehow makes me a bad person. I mean, what the fuck are they talking about? Like,
you're an inconvenience. I suppose it's inconvenient for them that people like you do go on those shows. And, you know, if you look at the lineups for Comedy Unleashed, there are numerous people of the left on there. But that, you know, they've gone down so far heavily this road that, well, it's just going to be right. Remember the originals? Yeah. Oh, it would just be Jim Davidson and Bernard Manning tribute acts. And then suddenly it was some credible comics. They were like, well, then again, just in the same way, there needs to be a new conspiracy theory, which is actually they're right wing and they've changed and they're making the odd left wing noise. I mean, I think that's the problem, as you rightly say, is if you're left wing, the brand is that you're the good guys, all right? So right wingers, you know, I've voted conservative many times, but you price in the nasty bastard shit, you know, like you work your way around that. You know, those people exist within the party and stuff, and it would be fatuous to suggest otherwise. But the problem with the Labour Party at times, particularly under Miliband and Corbyn, was like, where do you go after you've said we're the good guys? We'll stick up for you know, there's only one way to go.
Yeah, all they could do is do this sort of endless doubling down. But the thing is, you know, we're talking about that journey is, you know, 2017, you start 16, you start noticing things, 17, tweeting, 18. And that there was 2-3 years and it just really took over my life. Being on Twitter, arguing, having these arguments ready, having things. And then I joined the Lib Dems because I saw that was the only way in our area of keeping Labour out. And Catherine West had been rubbish during this whole Corbyn time. And I remember someone chasing me down the road, screaming at me like, how dare you, because I put a Lib Dem thing through there. This is a very late Labour area where I am, Crouch End and stuff. And even like one of my neighbors like kicked my Lib Dem sign. But it's just funny
that's such a weird idea. Crouch End political violence, and the person they're attacking is a fucking Lib Dem, but burning effigies of Joe Swinson.
Yeah, exactly. That horrible, horrible woman. But the point after the election, it was a very, I just sort of was just utterly exhausted. And my wife and I, and also looking at our neighbours slightly differently, like there hadn't been the support or anybody. Now, a few people have since, as more and more came out. But as you said, like, look, you saying that joke was a really big deal, because it was so frustrating knowing all this stuff. And every time the BBC or whoever would report on it, they would get stuff wrong or they wouldn't go all the way. And you're like, why can't you just ask one of the couple hundred people here who really know their shit? And you can, and Jews, you know, we knew about all this stuff way before everybody else, but no one was reporting on it. And even though Jews felt like we were like shouting, and like this idea that we control the media and all this stuff. And it's like, all of us were shouting and no one was listening or cared about any of this stuff. And then when Corbyn like allocated, like made his head of complaints, a woman who'd actually called out Rachel Riley, and who's just been, Rachel Riley just won her case against her. Like there was just, it felt like, it just like, where is this going? It was genuinely like a scary time. And I know that seemed, some people might see that as being feeling exaggerated, but that's what it felt. It felt like an onslaught. And because I guess people, if they're not in on it and aren't getting this kind of abuse, I had death threats, I had violent threats, even from people I know, but I had like on my Wikipedia page being attacked, like pylons online, abuse through my website, emails and stuff. I mean, it was sort of insane. And the thing is, I think like most people, is that I'm not traditionally a politically engaged person. I was quite happy just being like, oh, I'm Labour, that means I'm a good person and I'm just going to vote Labour and I don't want to have to think about any of the stuff. And I guess because, and this is the hypocrisy, is because of my own, is that because something affected me, I felt like that's what engaged me in that arena.
Okay, just butting in. Hope you're enjoying the chat with Josh there. Just to remind you of a couple of things. Also, for some reason, my podcasts on all platforms were only showing the last 100 podcasts. So everything from podcast 1 to 63. If you've got into it recently, you want to listen back to some of the old ones, some of the interviews, we've just made those live again now. So if you go back and refresh or update your podcast server, they should be there. Also, keep checking out Late Night Bash podcast that I've been doing with Olga Koch. It's basically, the concept of it is I'm the, you know, wannabe gammon. I'm the guy that's getting old and getting grumpy, and she's the kind of wokey snowflake, and we're trying to talk about cultural wedge issues and come to some sort of understanding. So do check that out, give it a rating and stuff like that. It's all good, you know, because Dave are paying for it and stuff. I don't want them to go, oh, we give you your own thing, Norcott, and no one fucking listen to it. So that would be good. I think you will enjoy it. Also, I've got a TikTok account. I'm trying to push this TikTok, and every time I mention it to my mates, they, it's not noncy to have a TikTok account. Maybe I need to do a national campaign for TikTok just to kind of get them some better PR among blokes my age. Jeff Norcott says, it's not noncy to have a Twitter. So for the time being, I'm not flogging anything in particular, but obviously there's a book. There's my book there. If you haven't, you know, if you've got an Audible account, I believe that you can use your credits and listen to it. If you have listened to it, obviously keep those reviews coming in for it and stuff like that. And let's welcome a few more patrons. I think two of these are returners again. Thank you, patron, for booting them out. Jane Haslam. I do remember Jane's name, Jane Haslam. Matt Wynn. We know Matt Wynn. We've mentioned Matt Wynn's many times. The Haslam Wynns. Are you married? The Haslam Wynns. Wynn is such a cool surname. Haslam as well. Were you in a fucking C.S. Lewis book? Or was it Aslan? I don't know. But anyway, thank you both of you for checking your accounts and reactivating them. And then this one, I think, is a new account, which is Colin Smithers. And I know, Colin, that your life took a turn for the worst. If that really is your surname, or maybe you're good mates with fucking Ian. Is it Ian Spamman? Ian Spamman and Colin Smithers. I mean, they do sound like two sort of sycophantic personal assistants. Smithers. So what you got to remember is that we don't know you. So we haven't met many people actually called Smithers. So can we just enjoy it for a while? But you must have been so pleased when The Simpsons got a bit less popular and Family Guy came in. Smithers. I mean, God, and every time you go on a stag do, there's a new group of blokes that are experiencing this joke for the first time and they have to run through the repertoire of gags. So God bless you, Colin Smithers. Thanks for your support. Okay, let's get back to the chat with Josh Howie. So we spoke a bit about what kind of guides you in terms of your sort of political and social views. I was interested. I mean, one thing that I've just got to remind myself of, you had this great routine about the fact that you were in a Jewish hip hop group. I can't remember the bloody name.
I was in a Jewish hip hop. It's all about wanting to be black, like a white guy wanting to be black. And so when I was 16, yeah. I was this Jewish hip hop group. We were called Circumcised. I was Snip Doggy Dog. And we wrote songs that dealt with the lifestyle of the young Jewish male, like Obligatory Tales and Life. Yes. Don't fuck with me, my father's a lawyer. And there was a song about wanting to be the same as everybody else, Slip Me Some Skin.
And this is a real thing that you did?
I used to.
Jewish lads doing some hip-hop.
I went to school in Notting Hill. I went to school down Portobello Road. And I used to go to this barber around the corner on Portobello Road that would like do this fade into the back of my head, the Star of David. But what happened was, I was actually raised as a Buddhist, and then
your parents, were they both Jewish?
So my mum's Jewish, my dad isn't. And what happened was, I was raised as a Buddhist, though. They were both Buddhist, and I was sort of forced to chant. But when I was about 16, I was at my grandmother's house watching this film called Exodus about the creation of Israel. And then I was like, wait a minute, why am I trying to... And I was desperate, and I was also... All my friends... It was a sort of classic kid with like my parents have money, but I'm trying to pretend I'm like super street and hanging out in Notting Hill, and you know, and all my mates are black. It's you know, it's pathetic, really. Not to have black friends, but just the enforced level of it, like me thinking that made me cool somehow. And also my accent was different, and just, you know, it was you know, I was a 16-year-old idiot. And so suddenly it was like, wait a minute, I'm Jewish. And then I sort of charged full into that identity and really almost created from nothing, because I never went to synagogue. I'd never I hadn't been raised Jewish in any way, but I just sort of became obsessed with it that it took over my entire life. So that when I was 18, 2 years later, I moved to Israel and I ended up trained to work on a kibbutz, but then I ended up training to be a rabbi. And I was there and then I got kicked out and that kind of all ended.
What did you get kicked out for?
I got caught. I did an Edinburgh show about it years ago called Chosen, but it was all basically, I got caught sleeping with a non-Jewish girl on Tisha B'Av, which is a very sad Jewish festival. And it was in Yeshiva, which is the Jewish rabbinical school. You are not allowed, the dormitories are like segregated. You don't have, and even the cleaners are men. So, but I'd met this girl in Tel Aviv. Like, we'd had a weekend off and I'd gone with my mates to Tel Aviv, and we met this girl on the beach, was a Roman Catholic girl from Rome with this big Star of David, with this bigger cross. But I kind of hooked up with her, but when we bumped into each other in Jerusalem, but we couldn't find anywhere to sort of be together. And then I knew that evening, because this is this big holy festival, that everybody would be down at the Wailing Wall at the Kotel, all the rabbis. So I knew everything would be empty. So I snuck her into my dormitory and I got caught by one of the rabbis, one of the head rabbis. And they were very, very angry at me. Rightly so. It was very disrespectful to their thing. I mean, look, but I was 18 and horny and an idiot. Nothing's changed. But
I love the fact that at that point your dick overtook whatever kind of
any spiritual absolute.
I mean, that's the one true God at the age of 18.
Of course,
is your dick and what it's telling you to do.
Absolutely, Yeah, they sort of politely asked me to leave. I think they were also frustrated with me because I think I was pretty good in the training. I think I would have made a good rabbi. Like, there's a lot of analytical thought. It's like, it's very puzzly and you're dissecting stuff. And I still do it to a degree in terms of religious commentary, like reading the Torah. And gives me great pleasure to kind of find interesting angles on things. So I think they saw that I had a sort of somewhat of a gift for that, but also because I had been raised secular in this kind of quite, hesitate to say cool. I mean, what it's called, but
life hippie-ish sort of trendy.
Yeah, like yeah. They sort of thought that I'd be quite good to send out there and be a, and then I could speak to the kids and be a cool rabbi or whatever.
You know what I mean? The zeal of the convert. I mean, that's what I think is interesting about your situation, because a lot of kids will be grown up in some kind of religious household and it will be very strict or small key C conservative, and then they'll rebel and become more free, new age. Yours is the exact opposite.
You absolutely. Know,
yours is quite hippie-ish and you've gone, fuck that.
Yeah.
I want to be in all male environments, no touching girls.
Yeah, that was exactly it. And it was a reaction to that, because being raised as a Buddhist, but my parents, they sort of, when I was 13, they dragged me off to live with Native Americans for a couple of weeks. And I did like a sweat lodge. I did like all these different like rebirths and tantric yoga and all this mad stuff that was kind of forced upon me, like any religious parent, but it was all hippie stuff. And so this was me pushing against that. But that also came out in terms of like, I never smoked. My parents, you know, did drugs, smoked weed and other things and whatever, but I've never done any drugs. I've never smoked cigarettes. So that was also part of that pushback, but that's not to say that Judaism as a religion, even though Judaism doesn't like the word religion, it seems more as a way of life, doesn't give me great pleasure and spiritual pleasure, you know? So I don't want to put it all on that. I wasn't trying to get religious when I was out there, but what happened was I was actually just very much a Zionist. I wanted to reclaim the land. But when I got out there, I was working, they put me in this, on this kibbutz, they put me in a kiosk selling ice creams, and I thought I was going to be like digging ditches. And I had this,
you know, yeah, that's not very kibbutzy. No, is it?
All of that had been done 50 years before. So they put me and said, they did it as their favor to me. Because actually on the kibbutz, all the volunteers weren't Jewish. They were all people there are a lot of people like hiding from different parts of the world. It's a bit weird, the volunteers. And actually they were very anti-Semitic, a lot of the volunteers, which is also strange. So I was the only Jew amongst these volunteers. And I think that the people who did the allocating of the jobs saw that and were like, oh, we're going to do you a little favor and put you in the Kushti job, which was in this sort of, this was down in the Engedi, it was in the desert. And so it was like in a kiosk and it was air conditioned and you could eat all the sweets you wanted. You just couldn't steal money, but, and you were just selling ice cream. They thought, and after I did that for about a month and I went back to them and said, look, could you, I want to do something hard, please. They thought I was mental. Like, what? So they put me in the date plantation, which was a nightmare. Like, I was up at 4 a.m. It was like, you're hanging off trees, you're getting pricked by the branches and these big welts. It was like a total, there were snakes, like the most poisonous snakes in the world, all of this stuff. And I was like, that was like, oh yeah, now I'm doing it. Now I'm reclaiming the land.
This is hilarious. The idea of you going there with such a sense of mission and then selling soleros to tourists, I'd imagine.
Yeah, that was the dream. And then, but anyway, finally, this guy joined from Canada, this Jewish guy, and he told me about this kind of scholarship thing where you, it was called the Jerusalem Fellowships, and they basically pay for you for a month to travel around Israel and you have talks and all this stuff. And I was like, oh, that's great. Well, they're going to pay for me for a month and I'll get to do all this cool stuff, go to Masada and all these places. Anyway, it was a brainwashing program, essentially, where they get these secular Jews, treat you amazingly, and then they kind of like, you do this cool stuff and then you do these lectures, and it's brilliantly designed so that, and of that there were about 50 kids doing it, and I'd say about 25 of us stayed on after the course finished, and then from that maybe even then 20 were then really into the rabbinical program stuff. So it worked amazingly well. So I didn't go out there to get religion as such, but I guess I always sort of say I got brainwashed, and I sort of did. And there's still a hold on me, even though it's 20 plus years later now. I believe in God, and I believe that God wrote the Torah and all this stuff. And it's not going
to
budge.
I mean, it's so funny because, like, you know, you've held on to you've sort of resurrected really a part of your family culture.
Yeah.
But also, you know, in Jewish culture, we understand like the importance of humor. And so, like, you don't strike me as like massively like orthodox, obviously, because like what you do and the subjects that you talk about, it would be difficult to do that. Although, you know, I haven't seen your stand up for a while, but it's interesting that in a way, like, you've sort of brought them both together somehow in a really unlikely way.
Yeah, well, I was raised culturally Jewish in that.
Yeah,
you know, we the bagels and the films and all of that stuff, and I knew I was Jewish. A weird thing happened to me when I was 13. I went to boarding school and we're all lined up by these older kids, and they started going around. They would pull kids out and they would say, what's your name and whatever. And then this guy got to me, he said, what's your name? And I was like, Joshua. He goes, what's your surname? Howie. And he goes, are you a fucking Jew? And I thought this guy was going to kick me. Now, I knew that I was Jewish. Like, I knew my mom was Jewish, and this guy was going to like punch me. And I said, yeah. And he goes, all right, mate, you need anything. So this guy turns out he went and joined the Israeli army. He turned out he was totally mental. And he,
Alfie Solomon from Peaky Blinders.
No, seriously, he was like that. And I inherited his desk a couple of years later.
Yeah.
And he had carved into it with a knife, Germany will pay. Like, this guy was like hardcore. But the point is, at that moment, 13 years old, this guy's gonna like, I think he's gonna punch me in the face or something, but something made me go, yeah, like, fuck you.
All of which, I mean, like, it sort of helps explain why you become such a fine comic and writer, and you know, I'd love for you to come back on the show, because I feel like there was a list of things I wanted to talk to you about, but it's so compelling to hear, you know, because it's in our recent past now, you know, the Corbyn years and what it was like to be Jewish and in Britain at that time. But something about the, you know, COVID and the a lot of the political events have happened now, that is a bit of time, and it was interesting to revisit it with you. In terms of your output and stuff, people should be following you across all social media. Is there anything else we should be directing people to check out?
I mean, I'm terrible at like the hustle. That's my thing. So I wish I should have sat down and thought. If anybody is interested, I mean, look, please welcome to follow me on Twitter. It's essentially me retweeting stuff about either anti-Semitism or the trans debate. That's with the occasional knob gag thrown in. But they're more than welcome to do so. please watch Headliners. I think it's, I just think it's a great show. I love, there are people on there I don't agree with politically, and the whole point of the show, and really the larger thing of GB News, is to have debate, which I felt like you weren't getting from the BBC, that wasn't being provided. And so, yes, I think there's been a few things that the people on the channel I don't agree with and whatever, but that's the point. But for me, when I go on, I say exactly what I want to say. But, and if I'm sitting next to someone who I disagree with, like Nick Dixon or Leo Kearse or whatever, we have a disagreement, we have a little bit of an argument, and then we move on to the next story. And it doesn't mean that we're not friends and don't respect each other or like each other. And that's obviously what's missing now, is this kind of, it's become this kind of the tribalism, that the element of it, that even by associating with someone who disagrees with you, damns you. And then
you're adjacent. You anybody. This new word, this new, remember you actually had to fucking do something wrong. Now all you've got to be doing is adjacent.
Yeah, literally sit next to someone who you disagree with. And even if you're saying the opposite to them, that's enough to
down. No, you were still breathing the same fucking air, Josh. I think that would be a good challenge just to end the show, is that somebody, if you do listen to this podcast, and I get plenty of lefties listen, and there'll be some people who still be going, GB News, I won't listen to it. Just a little challenge for yourself. Just one episode. Pick one when Josh is on and just watch it, and then just compare it. Do a little search online and just compare it to what's being said about it. And, you know, just, you know, always worth getting outside the echo chamber. And Josh, I mean, hopefully you'll come back in the near future and we can pick up the conversation.
Absolutely, man. Thank you so much for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Okay, so that was the chat with Josh Howie there. What a interesting bloke, and what a journey he's been on. And I want to get him back soon and talk, because there's so many other things that he's both an interesting and funny man to talk with and about. So do give him a follow. So as I always ask, you know, please keep the reviews coming in for this podcast. I've been lucky to have some good ones recently. This one's on Friday. If you give me 5-star reviews on iTunes, I will read them out. Please leave 5-star reviews everywhere, but iTunes is the only one I know how to access. So this one's on Friday from Timmers64. 5 stars and just a smiley face. This one from... Oh, right. So that was the only one. Just Timmers. No. This is a new one as well. This is from Pigeon Cottage. Oh, you definitely sound West Country. Love this podcast. Great interviews with some of my favourite people like Mark Steele, and lots of new voices. Plenty of, thank God it's not just me that thinks this moment. I usually listen when I'm gardening. I have nearly accidentally chopped my fingers off with the secateurs a couple of times when I've laughed so much. I mean, that really did fit that accent. And this one says that he may sound like your local plumber, but Jeff's take on current affairs is humorous and informative. And let's be honest, he's saying what we're all thinking. And that's from someone who calls themselves Vandal. So yeah, if you like the podcast and you're just listening to ad hoc, subscribe, give it a review. And remember, join the queue. Just join the queue, okay? This is Britain. Join the fucking queue.